Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. Hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice and interviews with the detectives who piece together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast, premiering Wednesday, October 1st. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts.
Falling in love when you're a single parent can be really challenging. You don't have a great deal of time to build a relationship. And of course, you have to be careful who you trust to have around your child. So when Laura Chapman moved next door to Darren Newton, she genuinely felt that she'd won the love lottery. He was kind, considerate, mild-mannered, stable. He had all the hallmarks of a perfect partner. And she allowed him access to her little boy, Charlie, because she trusted that he was a safe person to have around her child. Little did she know that Darren Newton was a sadistic predator, grooming her so that he could have access to her little boy. Today's case is that of the murder of Charlie Hunt. I'm Emma Kenny. Welcome to Bang to Rights, the deep dive crime podcast, which takes you through some of the most heinous crimes the world has ever seen. Today, we're going to cover a case that involves child death. With respect, that's always a really challenging arena, but I am obsessed with child safeguarding. It was a big part of my job, and I always want to explore how we can do things better. That's the most important thing when it comes down to a child dying. Was there a possibility that an intervention could have occurred, and should it have occurred, prevented the outcome? I'm going to talk about Charlie Hunt today. He was born on the 7th of August 2008. His mother is 29-year-old Laura Chapman. His father was 43-year-old Richard Hunt, but they actually split up as a couple shortly after his birth. This is when Charlie was around 4 months of age. So clearly was born into an environment where he had two loving parents, but nonetheless two separated parents right from the get-go. Now, Laura was actually already known to social services. She had two older children. They were both already in care. This is because they'd been living with the biological father. Bear in mind, this isn't Richard. Richard is just Charlie's father. This was her other partner who she had her initial children with. And care proceedings have been brought because allegedly the father assaulted one of them. So this is why the girls had been taken into care. Though it's worth noting that the reality in this is that they could have been with Laura if she had been considered a parent who maybe had the correct attributes to look after the girls. So it is interesting that Laura was somebody who was obviously allowed contact. She wasn't seen as the aggressor in this situation, but that they weren't actually residing with her. But nonetheless, Laura dutifully went and visited them regularly in West Yorkshire. And during this period of time, she also had Charlie, who was a little baby. So she needed a babysitter. And so she would leave Charlie with a babysitter. Also worth noting that in spite of the fact that she had two older children who were in care, Charlie was not noted or considered to be at risk of any harm. And the likelihood is that Charlie wasn't on the at-risk register because Laura was not considered a threat. It's also worth noting that social services genuinely were happy that Laura was coping well. When they looked at Charlie, he was a really happy, healthy baby. He was developing very well. So there were none of the markers, essentially, for him being on the at-risk register at that point. He was a child, to all intents and purposes, who was thriving. So Laura's obviously had a relatively high level of dysfunction at this point. She must have been through the mill emotionally. Having your children placed in care is going to be challenging. Having another broken relationship with the father of a new baby. There's a lot of issues there that would be very difficult for her. And she decides to some degree to make a new start. She moves to a property in Airby, Lancashire. This is in early 2009. And one can imagine, having dealt with the stresses and strains of the things that I've just identified, that she probably does have a level of loneliness in her life. She is a single mum. It can be really challenging when you're a single mum, particularly with a baby. Romance is not often on the cards. And the idea of meeting somebody and sharing your life with them is probably something that the vast majority of individuals want to achieve. And it happens for her. So soon after she's made this move, she begins a relationship with a man called Darren Newton. He's 31 years of age. He was a factory worker and he basically lived next door to Laura with his parents. So it's that proximity that delivers this new opportunity for a relationship. She literally moves next door. And clearly for her, that's gonna make things feel like life's taking a turn for the better. Because when you look at her history, she'd struggled. She'd been historically involved in relationships where she'd been a victim of domestic abuse. So her experience of men has not been a positive one. And trust is going to be a major feature in the way that she approaches a new relationship. And again, what we would say is that there are markers of vulnerability there, because she has engaged in relationships and remained in relationships at times that have been terrible for her and actually seen her violated violently by men. So understandably, when she meets Newton and he seems like this stable, responsible individual, he's got a job, he lives with his parents. I mean, 31 years of age, some may think that that is unusual for a guy to be living with his mum and dad, but if you're a single man and, I don't know, you get your ironing done and you get a lot of food made for you by your loving mother, it's not that strange. And I would certainly imagine that Laura would see this as a reflection of a great familial relationship, which is a big marker when you're looking for a partner. You want to believe that they understand the paradigm and dynamics of a relationship within a familial setting. And he has that. So he's got a job, connects with his family, seems responsible. Also, big plus as far as she's concerned, he seems very quiet, very loving, and very caring. So when you consider her past experiences, she probably is feeling like she's won the lottery of relationships with this new guy. One of the things that did stand out, however, very early on in the relationship and throughout it, was that he had this fixation with being overprotective about his mobile phone. So Newton did not like anybody to have access to his phone and he guarded it. And for a lot of us ladies and men out there, we'll be thinking, if my partner was guarding a mobile phone as if their life depended on it, I would find a way to intercept that mobile phone, to check it. That might be highly inappropriate of me to admit. But the more suspicious I am of your behaviour around something, the more I'll turn detective. Just putting it out there. Many of you might be like, it's a little bit weird, Emma. Just owning it, guys. Just owning it. Anyway, he's really overprotective of this mobile phone. And it just kind of strikes her as odd, but it doesn't stop her from continuing the relationship. Why would it? And the relationship does progress quickly. Now, I always say that when you have a child, no matter about your romantic feelings towards another human being, you have to really imagine what's best for them. And introducing somebody very early on into that child's life, so far as within your relationship with this new person, it can be problematic. It can be problematic because a child builds alliances quickly and gets used to certain individuals in their life. And if the relationship fails, that's pretty destructive for a child. But also, you don't know who you're inviting into your child's world. You really don't. You've got to give it a certain amount of time before you can truly believe that this is an individual who is trusted around your children. That noted, it is very difficult to state that case when another human being is feeling that they are falling in love. Very often it's at this moment in a relationship that people genuinely see the very best, sometimes the mythical, in the partners that they've met, and that's why things move fast. So she introduces Charlie to Newton, and essentially she believes that from the early stages of that relationship, it seemed to go well. In fact, she stated later down the line, to me, And to everyone else, he was loving and caring towards Charlie. Charlie would put his arms out to go to him. So she starts to believe that the building blocks of a relationship are clear and that Charlie feels safe with this man. Now, initially, she only would leave Charlie with Newton for very short periods of time. And the reasoning behind that is she wanted to know how Newton would cope. Bear in mind, he hasn't got a family of his own. She doesn't know how he will interact and react to children. And she was nervous because of this. He'd never looked after a baby that young. But very quickly, she starts to trust him. And she starts to feel that she can leave Charlie with him while she goes out to work. So now Laura is essentially building a family unit with Newton. The fact that she's letting him babysit while she's at work demonstrates that ultimately she felt that he was a safe person to have around her child. Again, it's the caveat, like I always say, when you're going to introduce somebody into your child's life, you really need to think about giving the relationship time to show its true colours. Hey, you might discover that after a couple of years of being with somebody that they are indeed the person that you believe that they were and you genuinely feel like you've struck gold. But it could be that you realize that they were just a wolf in sheep's clothing. And we see that time and time again. And the element that essentially proves that is giving your relationship enough time to turn either way. Now, later on in the same year, this is September 2009, Charlie ends up being taken to a GP. And the reasoning behind this was he vomited and he also had unexplained bruising on his hands. This straight away to me is a big red flag. The vomiting less so with respect, children get bugs, children are sick. But unexplained bruising on his hands, that's unusual for a small child. It really is, because when you think of an inventory and catalogue of injuries, you're looking at an understandable causation. So we expect to see certain things on babies. You know, babies bump their heads when they're learning to walk, for example. It's contextual, usually on the front of the head. And there are certain injuries that, like I said, bruises on knees. You can imagine that as a child is starting to try to pull itself across the floor, that they are going to incur these kind of injuries. But unexplained bruising on hands, that's an alarm bell for me, because how would a child do that? You're either going to think about somebody stamping on a hand, somebody trapping a hand, but arguably, it feels more likely that somebody else would be involved where this kind of bruising is concerned. Then 3 days later, Charlie gets taken to Airedale General Hospital. And the reason for this is he's having fits and convulsions. This, again, is relatively unusual. Of course, some people experience their children having fits and it's got nothing to do with abuse. But when you think about levels of injury, we often see injury and fits and convulsions going in the same bracket because of something going on internally, particularly where the head is concerned, if they've experienced a level of violence. So he later gets assessed by medical staff and they do carry out a number of tests. And Charlie is even kept overnight because they want to observe him. They want to know whether he's going to have any more fits or whether this was potentially a one-off. And even though they watch him and make those observations, one of the things that they come to the conclusion of is that he just seemed to have made a complete recovery. There hadn't been a recurrence of these fits, and so they decided that they were going to discharge him with an ongoing care plan. One of the things that they did note was that he was apparently clingy. And again, if a baby's been ill, and particularly if there is a primary caregiver around, often they just want to be clinging on to that primary caregiver. So this doesn't on its own symbolise a potential to be concerned. In fact, if anything, it's more contextual with what we'd expect to see with primary caregivers and their babies. But he seems to bounce back really quickly, gets back to his usual self. So even though the doctors have assessed him, they haven't felt that there is a need to monitor any further. We get to the 19th of November, 2009. Now, Laura recounts this morning particularly fondly and has memories of it because of a new game that Charlie discovered. And anybody who's had any interaction with toddlers will know that repetition is a big part of their play repertoire. When they discover something new, it's like an addiction for them, and they just get happier and happier and happier when that particular play is repeated. So he was meant to be in a really happy mood, and I would say testament to Charlie at this point that everybody who had had interaction with that child says that he was always a really happy baby, a smiley baby. But this morning particularly, he discovered a new ball game. And Laura would later explain this. She said, "I kept popping a ball in and out of my legs, and he thought it was hilarious that the ball disappeared out of his sight." So it was a really lovely morning where she was just really enjoying the development of her little boy, and of course, the joy that she would have experienced seeing how hilarious he found that situation. So Laura then later goes to visit her other children in West Yorkshire because she's keeping in contact with her children who are in care. So she leaves Charlie with his babysitter, but early that afternoon, Newton finishes his shift at the local factory. So at 2:30 p.m., he ends up taking over the babysitting duties. One thing that the babysitter noted was that she felt that when Newton arrived home, Charlie appeared to become anxious. There was just something that shifted in his mood. Now, even though this babysitter picks up on Charlie's shift in mood, it would be impossible for her to interpret appropriately and accurately what Charlie was trying to get across. Because the tale I'm telling you today...
Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. Hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice and interviews with the detectives who piece together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast, premiering Wednesday, October 1st. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts.
Is one of those that I believe very few people could have ever envisaged playing out. So Newton is now left in sole charge of Charlie. And 3 hours after that man got access to that little boy, 3 hours after he was trustingly handed Charlie, Charlie would be dead. At 4:30 p.m., Newton went next door to his parents and he says that Charlie's gone limp. So the parents obviously are terrified and they go straight away to help, and they find Charlie struggling to breathe. Also, they notice he's got a tremor down his left-hand side, so they immediately call an ambulance. At this point, even though the ambulance is on its way, Charlie becomes unresponsive. Newton's parents are amazing because you can imagine how distressing this is. This is a little baby, and they know that something devastating has happened to this child, and this child is no longer responding, so they attempt to resuscitate him. Fortunately, the paramedics arrive on the scene and they're able to take over the resuscitation attempts. Meanwhile, Newton calls Laura and he tells her that Charlie has had another one of these fits. He says that the paramedics are downstairs and that they're working on him. He also says that she needs to get to hospital quickly. So she sets off in an absolute panic. And one can only try to conceive of the feelings that that mother would be experiencing, having to get to the hospital, absolutely unaware of what was playing out, just believing hopefully that her child who's had a fit before has had another fit and is being treated appropriately. She could not for one moment imagine what she was about to find out. The ambulance rushed Charlie to Airedale General Hospital. This is a hospital in West Yorkshire. But they couldn't save him. The doctors tried, but he was pronounced dead at 5:45 p.m. Charlie was 15 months old. When Laura arrives at the hospital, she's taken into a family room. Anyone who's ever been in a hospital scenario where they take you into a family room, it tends to be that you're either going to get some really bad news or you're going to have to make a really difficult decision. So she was ushered in and probably knew that something potentially bad was going to be told to her. Newton's mother is already in that room and she's crying. And then she says to Laura, "I'm sorry." She says that she tried to save Charlie. Laura said that in that moment, time stood still. Everything just became a blur. And all she could think of was the fact that her baby, her gorgeous Charlie, had died before she'd even been able to get to him. She hadn't been there quick enough so that she could comfort her son in those final moments. Now, the doctors at the hospital were immediately suspicious, and the reason for that is that babies don't die on the whole. They genuinely don't. We have a really low level of child death in the UK. So the immediacy of the ideas behind why this child has died in this way is that potentially some harm has been done to them. They initially do an examination and they can find pretty immediately that, as far as they're concerned, Charlie died from a head injury. They said that they were able to find extensive bruising, and they also noticed bruises on the right eyelid, right cheek, and the right big toe. Also, his eyes appeared to have been damaged. They'd actually bled. So immediately we're thinking a serious head injury when that kind of hemorrhaging has occurred. And this is just from an initial examination. We're not talking about an autopsy. We're just talking about them looking at the child's body so they can tell that something truly catastrophic has happened to this infant. You know, this is a 15-month-old baby. How the hell does he end up with these kind of injuries? And remember, we're talking about injuries that automatically one would imagine would be in keeping with a car accident. And also, just to note, the right big toe having extensive bruising, that is not an injury that we would typically see with a child at any point. So the doctors are incredibly suspicious about Charlie's injuries, and so they contact the police. But even though I've ran through some truly terrifying injuries already, the true extent of them is going to become horrifyingly apparent in the postmortem. And it is just unspeakable, almost, what happened to Charlie. So the autopsy results showed that he had deep bruising on the top of the head. He had extensive bleeding to his retinas in both his eyes, damage to the optic nerves, so damaged that they'd become detached. So by the time of his death, he'd basically have been blind almost. Also, he had swelling and bleeding to the brain. There was an area of dead brain tissue. And some of the injuries that they noted dated back to when Charlie had actually been taken to hospital when he'd been suffering with the convulsions that he'd had 2 months earlier. Tragically, as we know, he had been discharged from hospital on that occasion, and it does seem that the doctors missed the signs of abuse. And one of the core reasons for that will be because he wasn't actually on the at-risk register at the time, so they weren't necessarily as diligently exploring the possibility that this is a child who was at risk. Now, the postmortem also was able to establish that the way that they believed that Charlie had died was that it was likely he'd had repeated blows to his head, and that that was probably what caused the fatal injuries. The pathologist concluded that considerable force must have been used, that the injuries were non-accidental and deliberately inflicted. So now the police launch a criminal investigation. And bear in mind, Laura, in this case, where she would be mentally and psychologically, she'd just been to visit her children in care, and now her son is dead. She wasn't even able to be there when he died. And there is a police investigation going on because it looks as if her son has been murdered. To try to process all of that information must be unbearably challenging. So now Newton, well, he he's arrested pretty immediately on suspicion of murder because he had been in the sole care of Charlie when the fatal injuries had been sustained. As Newton is being investigated, the police seizes technology, and that includes the mobile phone. Remember what I talked about earlier on? The mobile phone that he never lets anyone go near. Another reason why I'm the kind of person who would find a way to get hold of that mobile phone so I could check. Just saying. Very suspicious as far as I'm concerned. Why would you want your mobile phone to be tightly on your person and to not let anybody else look into it? To me, that is very worrying. So they get this, and when the investigators examine it, my God, they are absolutely horrified. And when I read about this case, this is what blindsided me. I mean, they're getting banged to rights because of this, but the point is, there is something about this crime that is amplified by what they find on his phone. So Newton has recorded himself, basically torturing this child. So he's recorded a series of physical assaults on this little baby boy. And this was over a 6-month period. That's from June to November 2009, just shortly before his death. So wrap your heads around that. For 6 months, this man has been taking opportunity to torture this little boy and to film it. The assaults had begun when Charlie was just about 1 year of age, and the seriousness of the assault had just increased over time. So he was getting more confident and more violent in the way that he treated Charlie. And in some of the videos, Charlie would be seen in a really happy mood. He was a really lovely, affable little baby. Not that any baby isn't, but some babies just aren't as smiley and cheery, are they? And he was one of those babies that was captivating that way. So Charlie's just happily gurgling away, or he's playing by himself. And then suddenly Newton would appear. And for no reason, not any palpable reason. Don't get me wrong, there's never a reason to harm a child. My God, I don't even believe there's a reason to tap a child when you're annoyed with them. I do not buy in to the way that that kind of discipline is used, and I don't think it's effective. But let's say that somebody is incredibly stressed because a child is screaming and crying and won't be quiet, and they act in frustration, still reprehensible, absolutely despicable, inexcusable. But we would say there was some kind of trigger for the behaviour, not for Newton. No. We're talking about a happy little boy just playing, just independently enjoying himself. And Newton just attacks him. Absolutely no other reason than to satisfy his dark nature. The investigators even find that the videos have been catalogued. Yeah, this sicko, probably not the most professional word, and yet I feel it fits appropriately. Is it just me? I think that we can use lots of different words, can't we? Sociopathic behaviour, so on and so forth. But I like the idea of just using the word sicko for this guy, because the fact he catalogues these horrific attacks on this toddler, this little infant, with titles including crying, no toys in pen, squeezing toe in cot 1 and 2, 2 minutes of pain, in which Newton slams Charlie's hand down on a high chair, then twists his right ear twice as Charlie is screaming and crying. Another one, shivering, no water. That was taken 2 weeks before Charlie was killed. And it shows Charlie shivering in an empty bath after the water's been let out. And that was filmed on an absolutely freezing night in November. Another one, happy slap, just shows Newton repeatedly the same day that he filmed that little boy in the freezing bath, slapping Charlie on the top of his head. He slapped him a total of 13 times. Charlie is screaming and crying in pain. Newton also forces his finger into Charlie's ear and twists it, and Charlie is literally seen with big tears rolling down his face. And what's even more heartbreaking is in this clip, you can actually see that Charlie's trying to raise his hand to defend himself. This is a little baby, and he hasn't got any power to prevent this predator from hurting him, but he's trying. It's absolutely heartbreaking. And then the clip ends with Newton kicking Charlie on the floor. That video was dated just 2 weeks before Charlie's death. In another clip, he cuffs and he prods Charlie. It's just inexplicable violence on a tiny one-year-old child. I cannot express to you, when I'm saying these words, the feeling I have inside about what I want to do to Newton. And I appreciate that this is a crime channel, and I appreciate that we are here to hear about a story, but I'm sure that many of you, if not all of you listening, the way it makes you feel when you think about this completely helpless little boy being savagely attacked by this grown man, and the fact that he's enjoying it, the sadism level is just terrifying. And all I want is to have half an hour in a room with Newton. Obviously, he would have to be tethered to a chair, but that's the way that I feel when I think about what happened to Charlie, because Charlie was completely defenseless. He was tortured sadistically by this excuse for a human, a man who'd been entrusted with his care. Now, Newton didn't film the final blows that Charlie was dealt on the 19th of November 2009, but obviously the catalogue of evidence against him is massive. But in spite of that, he denies initially harming Charlie. So during questioning, Newton basically tells the police, who I'm sure were trying to contain their anger when this guy is saying this stuff, I'm sure it must have been so frustrating, because those police clearly would have wanted justice for Charlie. They want an admission. They want this man who they have literal video evidence of abusing this child to admit it. But he doesn't. He just says that he's taken Charlie upstairs on the night that he died to get him ready for bed. And at this point, he hadn't noticed that Charlie's eyes were glazed when he tried to change his nappy. Glazed, bear in mind, his optic nerves and retinas had become dislodged because of the violence. So glazed would not be the word. Bloody would be the word. Terrifying, needs immediate medical attention would be the words. And he said at this point, he believed, looking at Charlie, that he was about to have a fit. And then, oh, how surprising, Charlie started convulsing. So this is what he's telling the police, who are like, yeah. You do realize that we've got your phone? Yeah, you've got my phone. I have nothing to hide. Well, you wouldn't let your partner or pretty much anybody go near your phone because you definitely thought you had something to hide. I just like my phone. I really like my phone. You've catalogued abuse of a baby that we clearly know that you've killed. I don't think that relates to what we're talking about today. I imagine it goes something like that anyway. So this is what he's saying. He's just denying that it's occurred. And the truth is that we know what had happened to Charlie suggested a completely different picture to the way that Newton's describing it, because nothing that he has said is consistent with the reality of how this little boy's life ended. So first of all, we have evidence of blunt force injuries. Without a doubt, he's been violently assaulted. And it's so challenging to imagine that Newton's fooled everyone. You know, bear in mind, he lives with his parents. His parents have tried to save Charlie. They don't realize that they've brought up this sociopathic, Machiavellian, malevolent force. As far as they're concerned, he's just the guy who goes to work and lives with them, and he's a kind, caring, quiet man. In fact, the people who knew him, and this was the vast majority of people who knew him, he didn't have a wide social network. He wasn't Mr. Popular. There was a level of introversion around him. But people considered him a caring and affectionate individual. He's a child abusing monster. but he'd lain in the shadows so effectively that no one had known anything about his nature. Charlie's mother, by the way, Laura, who's now ultimately going to be realizing that the man that she invited into her world, the man that she allowed to be alone with her child, was the man who'd murdered him. And she would psychologically be dealing with absolute distress. But she gets arrested on suspicion of murder as well. And this actually is relatively typical. We see a lot of cases where both parents are arrested on suspicion and then one is released. But that means that they have to go through some pretty terrifying territory of questioning and being made to feel that they either could have done more or that they are guilty of actually being involved in the death of a child. But she insists from the get-go she knows absolutely nothing about the abuse, and the police said that it was clear to them that she really was telling the truth. So they release her without any charge. Newton, on the other hand, is charged with Charlie's murder and multiple counts of child cruelty. He does plead guilty to 12 counts of child cruelty. But let's be honest, didn't have a choice, did he? I mean, he's got video evidence of the crimes, literally video evidence of the crimes, which directly connect the injuries that were found on Charlie's body that were historic to the videos that he's made and titled. But this means that as much as we would like to think this guy's taking some accountability for the crime, actually the likelihood is he's just putting his own self-interest first. He knows that if he accepts these child cruelty charges and says that he's guilty of them, well, that means it's an early guilty plea, and that means that he gets maximum credit when he's sentenced. I'm not sure anybody where child murder and cruelty is concerned should be allowed to get any credit whatsoever. I personally believe the term "we should throw the book at him" should actually involve throwing large books at him. Just putting it out there. It's like a literary way of stoning, for example. I'm not condoning stoning. I'm just saying, a hard book thrown at somebody who deserves it could sometimes satiate the feelings that we have anger-wise about these individuals. I don't know, using taxpayers' money to spend large amounts of time in prison because of the horrific crimes that they've committed, in this case towards a child. Sorry, I'm a little bit triggered by this case. Anyway, in spite of the fact that he says, okay, I'm going to be pleading guilty to 12 counts of child cruelty, he doesn't plead guilty to murder and to another 2 counts of child cruelty. So we've got him banged to rights on film, literally videoing himself doing it, clearly taking great pleasure in the fact that he enjoys torturing this child, but he's saying he didn't actually have the responsibility of murdering him. Now, personally, I find this kind of tactic relatively manipulative. This idea of, okay, I am guilty of that, but I'm not actually guilty of killing him. This idea of, well, if I take part responsibility, maybe the jury are going to believe that I have acknowledged the part that I've played in the death of this child, but didn't ultimately go out of my way to kill the child, thus negating me being guilty of murder. It's ridiculous, but it says something about his arrogance and the likely position that he thinks, meaning he can play the system. So the trial begins at Manchester Crown Court. This is in November 2010. Of course, Newton is putting on his best act, continues throughout to just claim innocence, because he said, literally, he never touched Charlie on the day he died. I mean, how do these individuals dream up in their crumbling brains that anyone is going to buy into this? Genuinely, if I was the defense, I'd be like, I really need to start thinking about representing some better cases, because this is a terrible one to be involved in. Because this man isn't just saying he didn't cause the death of Charlie, he's basically saying, hey, on the day he died, I didn't even go near him in that way. I didn't touch him at all. In fact, he said that Charlie was really happy and he was really content before he fell ill I mean, it's bizarre. The injuries that were brought forward in the post-mortem demonstrate that Charlie was not ill. He was a victim of a violent and sustained attack. Now, the defense barrister, he referred to previous neurological difficulties that Charlie had apparently experienced. And he argued that the degree of force needed to cause brain swelling to Charlie may have been considerably less than that of another child because of this. I mean, genuinely, is that the defense, Mr. Defense Barrister? You're basically saying, well, in the past, Charlie may have had some neurological difficulties. And the reality of this is that, you know, you don't need to punch him quite as hard for it to have a catastrophic impact on him. Then, I don't know, you'd need to punch a child who had typical brain function. Honestly, that's what he's saying. So this guy isn't guilty of murder, because he didn't realise that he couldn't punch Charlie as hard as he could punch a child without these needs. It's so messed up. Seriously, that is so messed up. Sorry, I just read the book on abusing typical children without previous issues neurologically. If I had read the neurologically impaired book and how to abuse children with these issues, he would still be here. It's just one of those mistakes, you know? Could have happened to any of us at all, any of you, all of you in the audience, jury. You all agree with me? No? Anybody? Anybody else think we're clutching at straws here? Honestly, it's really upsetting when I hear this stuff, because that's essentially what's being noted. That basically, you know, Charlie could have been beaten up, but if he had had no neurological difficulties, then he wouldn't have died. Anyway, fortunately, sense prevails with a consultant pediatrician who totally disagreed and said that the force needed to cause such injury would have been the same. So there is no doubt whatsoever that no matter what child we were dealing with, what infant was being affected this way, the way that that child had been abused, it would have had the same effect, no matter where you were with your neurological issues or otherwise. And the prosecution barrister, Dennis Watson, QC, stated this. The sad truth was that whatever the outward appearances, they had a dark and wicked side to the defendant, which only surfaced when he was alone with Charlie. That side to him was only discovered after Charlie had died. Between June last year and November last year, Darren Newton carried out repeated assaults and other acts of cruelty on a young boy called Charlie Hunt, who was barely a year old. Not only did he do that, but he filmed himself doing it on his mobile phone. I mean, that is damning, isn't it? Absolutely damning. And during a cross-examination, the prosecution accused Newton of deriving pleasure and enjoyment from the abuse and from watching the videos again and again. Now, Newton denied this. He gave absolutely no explanation for his actions. He only stated that he resented looking after Charlie. Really? Okay, well, just don't look after him then, you absolute freak. Your reasoning is...
Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. Hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice and interviews with the detectives who piece together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast, premiering Wednesday, October 1st. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts.
This child was an individual that took your time up and you weren't happy about that. So consequently, you decided to sadistically abuse him. I mean, it makes absolutely no sense. And the fact that he isn't willing to even acknowledge the sickness behind the recordings, because you don't video consistently abusing a child unless you want to see those videos again. Otherwise, there's no point. You certainly don't want to create a breadcrumb trail straight to your phone of just how dire your mindset is for the authorities to discover should a child be desperately injured or killed in this case. So it makes no sense that he would be videoing it unless he had a reasoning behind that, which would be a serious connection of enjoyment with this kind of sadism. So when he's actually cross-examined by the prosecution about the videos on the mobile, it goes like this. Watson QC says, "You're filming him as you inflict pain on him." Newton responds, "I accept that, yes." Watson says, "He tries to put up his little hand. What was going through your mind?" Newton, just again, no answer. Watson says, "Is it too difficult to admit you enjoyed doing what you were doing to him, which is why you did it again and again?" Newton responds, "I did not enjoy doing it." Watson says, "A helpless baby in reality, wasn't he? He couldn't speak, couldn't tell anyone, couldn't complain, could he?" Newton said no. And Watson says, "What were you trying to do in the happy slap video?" Newton says, "I don't know. I honestly don't know." Watson says, 13 times, that vulnerable area. Why choose his head 13 times? Newton says, "I don't know." Watson asks, "Did you take pleasure from the fact that you're being cruel to him?" Newton says, "No." Watson, "You gave them titles so you could look at them." Newton, "I didn't look at them over and over again." Now, bear in mind, this is an individual who's just been questioned about these horrific videos, and his response is to try to minimize it by saying, "I didn't look over them again and again," but also does have no explanation whatsoever for the level of hostility that he's inflicted on this child and the reasoning behind it. And that playing dumb does nothing to enamor you with a jury. It just means that you're hiding your reasons. Because for somebody to have actually orchestrated the kind of crime that I've talked about so far today and to document that and to title the videos of that, that takes a huge amount of thinking. It's not something that is a one-off. You've been able to consider what you've done. You've been able to think out new sadistic ways to harm the child, and then you've gone through with it and then you've recorded it so that you can replay it. So he's saying he doesn't know, but he absolutely knows. He knows more than anybody else in that courtroom why he did it. He's not sharing it, but he knows, just as we know, because he enjoyed it. He's a sadist, and he's a sadist of the worst type and level. He's a child sadist and a child murderer. Now, the poor jury members, they had to watch that video footage of Newton abusing Charlie. People in the jury were placing their hands over their mouths. Some court staff were literally in tears. Charlie's mother, Laura, and his biological father, Richard, they just had to leave the courtroom because it was just overwhelmingly painful. And Richard later stated, "I didn't know anything was going on. If I did, I would have stopped it. I would have done something about it. When I heard about the videos, I felt numb, thinking, what a sick animal would do something like that. I just can't get my head around it. Why someone would do that? Why someone like him would do this to a 15-month-old boy who can't protect himself? I had to walk out of court. I couldn't handle hearing my boy crying like that. He was crying for help and there was no one there to help him. Oh, I cannot even quantify the magnitude of the grief that man must have felt, the helplessness and powerlessness he must have felt of hearing his little baby boy crying in pain, scared, and knowing that he would have moved hell and high water to have assisted him, to have protected him, but he never got that chance. Now the jury, they took 40 minutes, that was it, of deliberation. Bear in mind, some juries literally take weeks. this case was so open and shut for them that within 40 minutes, they were like, this guy is guilty on all counts. And it's refreshing and heartening when you get this kind of result, because you know without a shadow of a doubt that justice is going to be served, because it was one of those cases that literally was documented by the perpetrator, so it couldn't have gone any other way. Interestingly, he was cleared of one count of child cruelty. I don't know why. I just think, what's the point? The guy's murdered a child, and also he's pled guilty to 12 of the other child cruelty offences. Maybe we could just throw it in, you know, because when you think about beyond reasonable doubt, is it? I mean, is it? I don't think it is it? I don't think it's beyond reasonable doubt that this man was a massive sadist who certainly deserves to go down, have a key thrown away, never to be found, with the hope that he will never walk the streets again. That's the justice that I would dole out on this human being, but obviously I am not a judge. So we get to December 2010, and Judge Stephen Irwin sentences Newton, and he sentences him to life with a minimum term of 24 years. Personally, don't think 24 years is enough when you think about what he's done. He described his actions as pure wickedness. He said it was a futile and wasteful death of an innocent toddler. He stated this, it was a series of repeated acts of cruelty for no obvious motive other than the wish to be cruel. Anyone who watches the video clips of some of what you did, and I am convinced you recorded only some of what you did, will genuinely struggle to understand why you came to do this. Charlie was in your care and you abused that trust. He was too young to tell his mother what you were doing so she could prevent it. Following the trial, Charlie's mum, Laura, she described Newton as evil and twisted, and she stated this, Charlie was an angel. He was always very happy. He loved to play, and he was a good eater and a good sleeper. Any mother would have loved to have been his mother of that little boy. If I'd had any suspicion about what had been going on, then I would probably be in the dock for murder myself. I'd have killed Darren. I didn't have any suspicions about what Darren was doing. I was in complete shock when I found out. I was hysterical. When I had to watch the videos, I was disgusted. It was extremely difficult to watch them, to see someone you love that much get hurt by someone that you trusted. I have to say, I am 100% with Laura. If he had killed my child and I had known that he had either seriously harmed or killed my child and I had got to him before the authorities, then it would be me in the dock, willingly pleading guilty to having murdered that individual, because it provokes that within you. And I understand how Laura feels and felt. Charlie's father, Richard, said of Charlie, he was a cheeky little monkey, always laughing with a cheeky smile, and that's how I want to remember him. It's incredibly painful for both of those parties. Now, there was a serious case review into Charlie's death, and it was conducted and published in January 2011. The report did conclude that Charlie's death might have been avoided. They said, had his background been fully explored when he was admitted into Airedale General Hospital when he had those convulsions in September 2009, they may have been able to recognise that he was a victim of abuse. But tragically, he was discharged without the abuse being considered as a cause for his condition. Whilst the report and the review did state it was impossible to actually have predicted the abuse, it did conclude that different interventions might have led to a different outcome. So if they had suspected that something was going on in Charlie's life and it had been brought to light, then the consequences may have been that Newton would have changed his behaviour because he would have been aware that he wasn't going to get away with it, or Charlie could have had some protective measures placed around him. So it recognised that there were these issues in gaps regarding provision. Also found evidence of gaps where it came down to information sharing and planning between agencies. So they found that there was a failure to recognise the potential for Charlie to suffer harm. They believed that there was an overly optimistic view of the capacity of Charlie's mother to safeguard him because she had children in care, she had a history of getting involved in relationships that weren't good for her, and maybe a new relationship should have been investigated just because of that prior experiences. Not blaming Laura at all, just saying that the services were aware that sometimes her choices were not the best choices for herself and consequently potentially for her children. And if maybe there'd be some structured support around that, there could have been a different outcome. So they believed that that GP did have enough information to consider that Charlie was at risk, and the failure to explore this possibility was a missed opportunity. As ever, the report concluded that lessons must be learned. Lessons must be learned. Every single child death case that I've covered, insert this finding. When will the lesson be learned? I'm waiting. It's bizarre. I literally sit here and feel like I am a parrot repeating myself, because it's something that we have heard a lot in tragic cases like this, and it really feels like lessons are not being learned. Following, for example, the horrific case of baby Peter Connolly in 2007, social services vowed such a thing would never happen again. However, just to put it out there, guys, 5 years later, at least 100 children under the age of 2 had died in similar circumstances. You heard me correct. 100 children under the age of 2, just 5 years after the loss of baby P, died in similar situations. The report suggests that around 20 baby Ps die every year across the UK, which is harrowing. In fact, it's unforgivable that these little babies are born into situations and die in situations that could be prevented. Now, Laura Chapman, his mother, remember she already had 2 children in care. And therefore, for me, certainly in my experience of working in safeguarding, and certainly just on a logical, common sense point of perspective, is that social services would have monitored Charlie's welfare. Because at the end of the day, even though she wasn't the person who was the problem in her relationships, the point is that there was a prior experience of problems in her history with her children. And Charlie, being a new child for her, but certainly with the historical issues that I've mentioned, it would have been good to have him on their radar to help her, just to help protect her and him. You know, we know she had a history of relationships where she was a victim of domestic violence. The father of her eldest kids had assaulted one of them. But for whatever reason, social services didn't investigate or monitor Newton. So they just allowed this strange man, and boy was he strange, into this child's life without really taking responsibility to explore whether he was a safe person, and to visit regularly enough so that they could know if things were changing regarding Charlie's demeanour or any injuries that were occurring. Now, that noted, the serious case review found that it was extremely unlikely that Newton would actually have been identified as a risk to Charlie, because he was really good at pretending to be a loving and caring person in his life, and all the adults that were around Newton also validated and verified that he seemed to be a decent human being. But the review did conclude that there should have been a more cautious approach to his involvement with the family. And I absolutely agree. There should most definitely have been a more cautious approach to him getting involved with the family. I think there should have been boundaries and caveats placed in his access to Charlie based on what we know about Laura's background and experience. Since Charlie died, Laura has received a huge amount of criticism following her son's murder, and that's to put it mildly, guys. Now, understandably, we all feel very triggered when a baby is murdered, and in this case, people were absolutely horrified at the nature of Charlie's death, and people were also skeptical because Laura already had two children in care. So there were some heavy judgments. Some people found it absolutely unbelievable that she had been completely unaware of the abuse. She hadn't noticed the injuries to Charlie. She hadn't noticed a change in his behaviour, especially around his abuser, because what the babysitter had said was Charlie did seem more anxious around him. But Laura made it clear at the time that if she had had any suspicions whatsoever, she would have been the one in the dark. In her own words, she would have killed him herself. And the police were most definitely satisfied that she had no clue, because bear in mind, if they had felt that she was aware of the abuse, she would have been culpable also. She would have faced child cruelty charges as well. And it's very easy when you feel so upset by the needless death of a child to want to pin blame. It makes us feel that if we can blame people, as well as the person who perpetrated the crime, but blame those around who we believe could have prevented the death of that baby, it makes us feel better because we think that it wouldn't happen to us or we'd be able to stop it happening to somebody else. It's just the nature of how we like to control our environment. But we genuinely should have sympathy for Laura. I mean, I don't know her. I don't think she'd have won Mother of the Year award, but Charlie was a happy, healthy baby before Newton appeared on the scene. And she has lost her child. He has been murdered. And Laura has described the guilt that she lives with now. She said, I entrusted him with the care of the one main thing in my life. And for him to do that is a betrayal of my son, myself, and everything I know. I'll have to live with the error of my judgment until the day I die. And that is something that really resonates with me, because I imagine that every single moment of every single day must be drenched in the pain and the guilt associated with Charlie's loss. Newton was a chameleon, let's be honest. This is a guy who is able to portray himself as a caring, loving individual. Those closest to him, including his parents, had no idea of his nature. He had no previous convictions. He blended into society appropriately. He worked. Yeah, he lived with his parents. Like I said, some people might think that that's a little bit strange at his age. Others may see that as a positive because it indicates a pro-social relationship with his family. But this is an individual who was incredibly deceitful. And a deceitful character is symptomatic of many personality disorders. We know that Newton lied consistently, created a completely false persona, and he did this to get what he wanted, which was an opportunity to fulfill his warped, sadistic ideas. And to do that, he was really happy to exploit those closest to him. He fooled Charlie's mum, Laura. In front of her, he was acting like a kind, gentle, loving father figure towards her son. And no doubt he acted that way to her too. All the while, systematically abusing and torturing a baby boy. You know, she is there believing that her life is improving because of this relationship with Newton. She thought that she'd found somebody who was going to benefit her son's life. Newton was great with Charlie when he was in public. And social services certainly had no concerns, even though Laura's two eldest children were actually in the care system. Friends and family evidently had no concerns. And there are no reports of anyone who knew or had literally anything to do with the family expressing any concerns to the authorities regarding Charlie's welfare. Even the health professionals didn't spot the signs of abuse. That includes both her GP and the doctors at the hospital. So when you think about the reality of all those individuals being fooled, the idea that Laura is treated very badly by very many people on social media seems harsh, because she's living that pain every day. Even if you read news articles of this and you look at the comments section, wow, the comments are really unfair. They're cruel. Some have completely demonized her. They say that she was complicit in the abuse, but the police were absolutely satisfied she had nothing to do with that. And the media have been clear about that. Also, none of the people pointing the finger at Laura were actually in her situation. And I wasn't there either. And I come down hard on parents that I believe are complicit. You know that. But in this case, it feels like it's more important to place ourselves in Laura's shoes. Because when you take into account what we know, we always have to remember that people like Newton, who, shall we say, have malevolent personalities and an ability to be a chameleon-like in the way that they act, to make somebody feel that they can be trusted. We see this with perpetrators. We see this with individuals who sexually molest children. In fact, they get into a partner's life specifically because that partner has children, and then they make them feel like they are answering all of their prayers as a partner, and it's all about grooming. And there are people out there who are PhD level groomers. And Newton, as far as I am concerned, is somebody with a real malevolent, dark personality, sociopathic in nature, and somebody who wanted to harm a child, somebody who enjoyed the feeling of power, somebody who was really exhilarated by the torture that he inflicted. And he saw Laura, and he saw that she had a child, and that became his fixation. Weaving his way into her world so that he could do exactly what he wanted to do to her little boy. Newton controlled everyone around him, his own parents, Charlie, health professionals, social services. He consistently fooled them all. None of them spotted any signs of the abuse over a 6-month period. As I've mentioned before, the babysitter did notice on the day that Charlie was murdered that he seemed anxious, but she admitted in court that she genuinely thought nothing of it. Imagine how Charlie would have felt in that moment. Charlie would have known his mother wasn't at home. He knew that this perpetrator was an individual that hurt him constantly. He must have known that there was a potential for violence to occur that day. That must have been why he was so anxious. A lot of people still, in spite of the fact that Laura has been exonerated, believe that she must have known, that she must have been aware of what was playing out, and they refuse to believe otherwise. But I genuinely feel that tragically for Laura and for Charlie, she really was fooled. I don't think for a moment she realized what kind of a predator she'd invited into her life. She thought that he was potentially going to be a great stepfather, all the while not knowing that she was being controlled by him. She's been a victim in the relationship because he probably never had any feelings for her. He just wanted to carry out his sadistic desires on her little boy. She's a victim as a mother because she's lost her child. Richard's lost his son. Together, they have, as parents, lost. And Laura's 2 other children, they lost a brother. And ultimately, no matter which way you cut this, there's only one person to blame, and it's definitely not Laura. I can't imagine the living hell that she's gone through. I can't imagine the living hell.
Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. Hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice and interviews with the detectives who piece together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast, premiering Wednesday, October 1st. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts.
That her and Richard are still going through. Son murdered by the man that she believed that she loved. A man that she thought was a father to Charlie. Losing a child is beyond a shadow of a doubt the most painful thing imaginable. But losing a child in Laura's circumstances, I can't even begin to wrap my head around that. When you look at Charlie, well, for the majority of his short life, he'd been a happy child. That's what everybody who met him thought. And that alone has to be testament to the fact that prior to Newton walking into Laura's life, she made that child happy, as did Richard. Even though they'd split up, clearly their interest was in making sure that Charlie was loved and knew that he was safe and wanted. And if she'd never met Newton, that's how it would have continued. You know, you think about the torture that he suffered in private for his last 6 months of life. Well, Laura has to live with that. There can't be any form of closure for her. To be on the receiving end of such hate and abuse from the public after this tragedy, it must be horrific. Because she's never going to forgive herself. She didn't realise what was going on. And as far as it goes, she literally opened the door to her son's murderer. She brought her son's murderer into his life. And she wasn't there to protect him when he needed her the most. And that's why I think she doesn't need any more punishment. And social media and comment sections, they breed that ground where there is a permission base to harm more the already harmed. Most of all, I can't imagine the confusion and the fear that one-year-old Charlie must have experienced. Can you imagine being a little boy and in public, you have this man who, to all intents and purposes, is loving and affectionate towards you. And Laura said, as did others, that Charlie would reach out to Newton asking for him to be held. But then in private, it would have been the exact opposite. Can you imagine being Charlie and thinking, why is this man, this person in my life, so nice here and then so scary here? It's so confusing. And how, to some degree, would a one-year-old in such a situation even demonstrate to his mother the sign of fearing Newton? Because the other thing is, he wouldn't have been like that when his mother was there. So Newton would have acted wholly appropriately when Charlie was with Laura in a situation together. So again, it was only when Charlie knew that Newton had access to him alone that he would have probably shown the distress. The rest of the time, this man was just nice to him. Newton would represent both love and hate to Charlie. How can we even begin to imagine how a one-year-old mind could even start to rationalize that? I find it really difficult to comprehend the mindset of someone like Newton. And I'm going to put my own slant on it. Feel free to disagree with me. But whilst there was no physical evidence of sexual abuse, so on Charlie's body, they didn't turn up historic sexual abuse injuries. There was nothing telling in that way. Personally, I think he must have gained some kind of sexual satisfaction from his actions, genuinely, because he recorded himself doing it. Me, personally, that's because he enjoyed viewing it again and again. And I genuinely think that people who are real sadists, who enjoy domination and torture and all of the horrific things that go with that, part of that is because it manifests something sexually for them. And I believe the reason that he videoed those particular events is because he probably intended to share the footage with other people with such warped predilections, other sadists. Because he absolutely enjoyed inflicting pain and suffering on the most defenseless of humans possible, a little child. Just enjoying that sense of power, knowing that there was nothing that baby could do. He couldn't even speak to let people know what he was enduring. That man knew that Charlie couldn't defend himself, couldn't fight back, couldn't communicate the abuse he was suffering. And Newton enjoyed the fact that he had full control. So he lied, he abused, he controlled others to hide the abuse. And this predatory behavior that he exhibited, it was so effective. He was such a good con artist that it didn't just give him access to Charlie, It allowed him hours and hours on end alone with Charlie. And that meant that he got more confident. He became more able in his amplification of the abuse because there were no repercussions. So the abuse grew worse and worse with time. He realized he could get away with it. So he evidently wanted to inflict as much pain, as much suffering on Charlie as he could get away with. But he went too far. And that 15-month-old little boy's body finally gave out. During the investigation, the police also analysed Laura's phone records, and it indicated that the abuse that poor Charlie had endured had taken place when she was in West Yorkshire visiting her two older children. So he planned it for those opportunities and times. It's not surprising that, like I said at the very beginning, he was so protective of his mobile phone because it held the secret to who that heinous human being was. And the judge's comments were absolutely correct. What he was filming would have been the tip of the iceberg. It doesn't bear thinking about how many other times he abused Charlie, how often he had the opportunity when he was alone with him. You know, the phone would not have recorded all of those events. And it's horrific to think that Newton was in loco parentis. You know, he was the figure that was meant to represent a safe person, a father, shall we say. Even though he was not Charlie's biological parent, he was there in the place of the parent. He was there to love and protect and care for this child, and he did the exact opposite. From the get-go, he just wanted to harm Charlie. You know, his role was to love and to care for Charlie, and instead he did exactly the opposite. And he just wanted to harm Charlie. That's how he got his kicks. If you think about an individual with antisocial personality disorder, and we're talking about really severe spectrum, we can say that typically they struggle to form intimate, meaningful relationships. And that could explain why he was a 31-year-old single man still living with his parents. So there might be some signs that we could have taken that suggest there was something a little bit strange about this individual. But like I said, for the most part, I don't think it would ring any alarm bells whatsoever. But without a doubt, he was a great con artist. So we can see that there are certain traits within him that certainly demonstrate that antisocial connection. Newton's also expressed little or no remorse. Don't ever let him out of prison would be my response. I literally cannot get my head around the fact that somebody can go to prison for something that is clear-cut and not be remorseful. Certainly demonstrates that he has no empathy and a high level of callousness within his mindset. He's also never offered an explanation for his actions, although I understand that. There is no explanation. There's never an acceptable explanation for murdering a defenseless little boy. Simple as. I'm recording what you did to him. He's also written recently to a pen pal from prison. Somebody should immediately go to the house of that pen pal and take that pen pal for a period of time where they can be assessed. Because why would anyone choose to write to a child murderer as a pen pal? You know, I like the 80s when, you know, your school, a degree that you'd write to another school and each of you would get a pen pal. Maybe you'd try writing in French, for example, and it would be so innocent and naive and cool. And who knows, over the years, it could even relate to a friendship. That, to me, is what symbolises pen pals. Not, I feel like I'm a bit bored at the moment. I feel like I could do something for my community. I'm quite good at writing letters. Maybe I'll write some letters. Maybe I'll become a pen pal. What kind of person shall I get for my pen pal? I think I'm going for a child murderer. Genuinely? Who are these people? Anyway, in this situation, he claims he's innocent and he didn't kill Charlie. And he wrote, I have never laid a finger on a child. Okay. I mean, we have videos of you doing it. He even had the audacity to write this. I just want justice for the child in me. Getting a guilty verdict wasn't justice. Tell you what would be justice. Getting a full life term where you never walk the streets again. And then when you take your last breath, being given a one-way ticket to hell for eternity, where you burn very, very, very hot. At the end of the day, for me, he's bloody lucky that he got a minimum term of 24 years. And bear in mind, he's now served half of it, which drives me mad. Personally, it really disturbs me when somebody is inside proclaiming their innocence, even when it's been videotaped their guilt. And you just have this feeling that writing that stuff to a pen pal, suggesting that he's innocent, potentially even asking for his sentence to be reduced, because he's even asked his pen pal about the chances of getting his convictions overturned. I mean, who is this pen pal? Like, really? And the very fact that he believes that he should have a right to walk our streets again before the full term of his sentence is served means he hasn't changed at all. And if you were the pen pal watching this, could you write back to him and say, no, you can't have your conviction overturned. You're guilty as hell. Lots of love, Emma Kenny. Understandably, I don't think that any of us can find anything positive in this case whatsoever, but it kind of keeps me warm that I know Newton will not have a good time in prison. Because inmates really do not like baby killers. It's the lowest of the low as far as the food chain of inmates goes. So you never know. He might just meet some very large, violent fellow sadists on his prison wing. I hope he enjoys their company. I genuinely hope that Charlie's mother and family get some form of closure one day. I hope that one day they'll be able to look back at Charlie's very short life and celebrate it how it deserves to be celebrated. This little boy should be growing up amongst us. He should be an individual whose life is full of love, as it was until the day that Newton walked into his life. And arguably, like I've said, if there's one thing that we can learn from this, it's that Laura, his mother, has already suffered an incredible amount and has to endure knowing that so many people believe that she was culpable in this scenario. Whereas really, she was just a victim of serious grooming. She would have done anything to change the outcome. This has been a tough one, hasn't it? How do you feel that he only got 24 years? Literally, how do you feel about the fact that he's writing to a pen pal who is hearing that he believes firstly he's innocent and secondly, hey, can I get a few years shaved off my sentence? Does it infuriate you as it infuriates me? Do you all agree that we should be allowed to throw heavy books at him? Sorry, again, not very professional. You know what I'm saying. Maybe some kind of fiercer repercussions would be more appropriate in a case like this. And sometimes I feel like I tell the same story again and again. There are just failures in the way that children are protected. That's it for Bang to Rights today. Join me for the next episode. See you then. Be safe.